And now we are officially being recorded. So I'd like to welcome everybody out to our Regional Growth Committee this morning. The record is August 20th, 2020. It is 9:45 a.m. And I am Tina Cannon, Council Member in Morgan County. I'm invited.
I don't know if anyone else is hearing. I don't hear anything. It completely cut out.
Yeah, it's cut out for me as well.
I haven't heard anything. Yeah.
I don't hear anything. Maybe if everyone mutes themselves, that would help.
Was working from earlier.
This meeting is being recorded.
Hey, that computer's on mute.
Ready?
Three.
Can you hear us?
All right.
A little echoey.
Test this. Can you hear us?
It's crazy feedback.
Okay, let me call that.
I'm going to turn off the audio.
Can you hear us?
Is that better?
A little bit. Talk again.
I wonder if we should maybe
give us the thumbs up now.
No, it's very echoey. I wonder if we should just mute on your guys' end and maybe possibly just call in on a landline. What do you guys think about that?
I think if everyone mutes themselves except the speaker, we won't have any feedback.
I just X out of this completely.
Okay, can we hear them? Can you hear us now?
Yes.
Right. Are you able to hear us now?
Yes.
All right. Appreciate your patience with us as we do this. So backing up, we excused Don Ramsey this morning, and we are moving into a roll call for the record.
Okay, and you don't need to say present or anything. I'm just going to read your name as off the participant list. Amy Winder Newton, Andrea Olson,
Andrea Pearson.
That's me. And Andy Hola, Ari Bruning, Bryce Bird, Ben Hewitt, Ben Wethridge, Beth Holbrook, Bridget Mandel, Mayor Dandoy, David Ward, Evan Curtis, I'm assuming Gary Urson?
Your ask.
Okay, Grant Farnsworth. Jen Robinson. Julie Fulmer. Kendall Thomas. Kevin Van Tassel. Len Arby. Mark Allen. Reed Ewing, and various other WFRC employees and attendees, which I will note.
Right.
We have a quorum.
All right, so it has been determined we have a quorum and we are able to move forward. So our first action item this morning is the approval of the Regional Growth Committee meeting minutes held on May 21st, 2020. I would make that motion to approve those minutes. Do I have a second?
This is Amy Winder Newton. I'll second that.
Thank you, Amy. All right, do I do an all?
Let's perhaps do that and then signify with a thumbs up or something.
So all in favor with a thumbs up signify. All right. Anyone opposed? Looks like it's unanimous. Thank you, everyone. All right. So going on to agenda item 2, we are in our public comment period. So do we have any members of the public who are on the meeting today who would like to speak to items on our agenda? Seeing none, we will move out of public comment period. Our third item on the agenda today is a review of the Wasatch Choice implementation resources. If everyone will recall, the Regional Growth Committee has been talking about the challenges we face in planning during a time of rapid growth. Now to add to the challenges we face with COVID-19, we also have growth issues and a difference in tax structure. There are all sorts of things that are impacting us through this time period. It's really a time of change and transition. So as we talk about what we have been doing, what our plans are, and what the impact to those plans will now be based on our new normal and our new transition period into the new normal. So I'd like to turn this time over to Scott Hess to talk about what some of the things that we are doing here at Wasatch Choice or Wasatch Front Regional.
Kelsey, can you guys hear, can you hear me okay? I don't have a very good internet connection, so I'm video off. But can you hear me all right?
Yep, you're coming in loud and clear. Thanks, Scott.
Perfect. And thanks to Katie for sharing the screen. So I hope everybody's had a chance to take a look at the blue sheet that we prepared on this. That was a great introduction. Thank you very much. And just as a reminder, back in the fall and winter of 2019, which feels like a long time ago now, the Regional Growth Committee and the Wasatch Front Regional Council asked staff and our partners to look at resources that were going to assist them with these difficult growth conversations. So now we have compounded on top of that what we're dealing with COVID. WRC has not forgotten that local communities are still working through the impacts of COVID, but I think that these resources will provide communities help, and it's also a time to reflect on what kind of communities you want to develop and will be poised for long-term recovery and enhanced community resilience. So the partnership effort that we're working on will assist local governments with updating general plans and really position us to thrive and be resilient in the future. So what I'd like to do today is review with RGC a few of the key objectives of the working groups. So I won't go all through all of the objectives for the four individual working groups. I'm just going to pick a few of them. And as we review these objectives, we're going to ask the RGC to consider how could these resources potentially be enhanced, what we may be missing, and how your community might utilize these resources. So happy to jump to answer any questions. Feel free to jump in if you have any input on these, because what we want to do is utilize the feedback from the RGC, take it back to the groups, and make sure that these resources are going to be usable at the local level. So to begin with, I'm going to start at the communications working group. Their objective is really to develop a communications plan to address regional and local planning. And I'm just going to go through a couple of the tactics of that communications plan to give you an idea of what it looks like. The goal of the communications plan is to support conversations about the future with Wasatch Choice principles that will accelerate recovery and promote sustained quality of life along the Wasatch Front. So we've really expanded the conversation beyond just the growth pressures we're feeling and thinking more towards holistic economic recovery and what our communities will look like in this new normal or post-pandemic. The primary tactics of that communications group or that communications plan is going to be developing a frequently asked questions or a first sentence document that addresses hot topics on density, pace of growth, congestion, et cetera. So I'd ask you as a local elected official, would your city councils, would you as mayors and commissioners utilize that type of document? If there was something that said, what would your community do if, and then you could answer those questions that address growth planning, economic recovery, and having a few of those positioned with Wasatch Choice 2050 talking points to perhaps assist your community with linking regional needs with local planning. The second is going to be social media sample assets. So these would be back.
Scott, can I just interject? Do you want to get some feedback on that now or while you're going through this?
Yeah, I'm going to, the second piece of that communications are going to be social media samples. And then I'll pause and ask the question if there's any feedback. So so that second piece would be factoid graphics and uniform hashtags. And this would be with an eye towards providing consistent communication around regional growth, around economic recovery, pandemic recovery, that our communities can utilize that would kind of, I think, rally the region around Wasatch Choice 2050, which is essentially your plans that we've rolled together on a 5-county and then plus MAG area. So I'm going to pause there and see if there's any feedback, questions, concerns, or really help us answer the question, is this going to be a usable resource for local government, and how can we make it the best for you?
So Scott, I think this is a really good plan, but one of the things that I've been running into is we've been trying to adjust up in Morgan County to what's going on and who's been affected. I am finding that, and I don't want to throw anyone under the bus because we're all in that same bus, but for local officials and support staff to really understand how taxes are structured in Utah and how much of our revenue is dependent on commercial activity. And when those commercial activities, which are valued at 100% of resale value or of property value, when they take this type of hit in value, what that's doing to our projected revenues and where it's shifting in school districts and in counties and cities that are dependent on property tax, how that's shifting to a residential value and increasing the tax burden on our residents as well. So as we look at that, the state is funded differently than local government, but WFRC is really that consortium of local governments. So as we look at this planning and what it's doing to our budgets long term, I think that has a key, it's a key part of the conversation in making sure that as we are looking at these plans and our budgets, that we're understanding what the impact of this is going to be on revenues. I use revenues lightly here because I do realize we're a taxing entity. We are taking out of the system, but that is the reality of government. So as we look at this, that piece that would be helpful, I believe, is that we are having that conversation for how it's impacting budgets and what we see it happening across the region. Anyone else have a thought or comment?
Council member, can I jump in on this one? So Scott introduced this concept of the crucial conversation or the conversation starter. And I think it would be helpful if any of you have a reflection on, what's a challenging reaction that you get in, let's say, in a city council meeting that you wish you had, perhaps a starter on, well, how do I start to respond to this? And I'll give you an example. I think that I find that sometimes in community conversations, there is this, if a project comes in and it's a denser development than the community is used to, that there is this feeling like, well, that's the camel's nose. If we allow this one development that is more dense, well, surely then we may be allowing higher density across the entire city. And we know that that's not always the case, but how do we approach that as a community, having that conversation? That's one example, and I'm just throwing out that if there's particular concerns that you see recurring in your communities, those would be useful things to share, and then we can think about, well, you know, what's the analytics to Council Member Cannon's point that might support an answer? What's a communications approach? What are ways to talk to and through the key concerns that residents might have?
Hey, Scott, Ted, by the way, this is Bob Dander out of Roy City. Thanks for your comments, Ted. It's surely a segue to some things that I'm experiencing right now. Let me just make it absolutely clear from my perspective. I don't think people really understand what 2050 really means. I think they're assessing what they have in the next year, what they're doing in the next year, because they're looking at it from a political perspective. But the one thing I have found, and it always seems to be an issue, is who's driving the future of a city, particularly a smaller city. And some may say, well, it might be the city manager, it might be the mayor, it might be the city council. I think there's a lot of options there. But the fact of the matter is that we have got to deal with the 2050 option that says population is going to explode across the Wasatch Front. And there's this feeling out there that what we need to do is hold back the inflation and the transfers coming in from California of all these people wanting to basically invade Utah. The fact of the matter is that is not the case. We're talking about the majority of the people who will be living in the 2050 era are going to be our children, our grandchildren. And I think if they really understand the facts and understand that we're dealing with the situation with you with population opportunities with our own children, then maybe we can start to have them think a little bit broader and say, really, we need to consider some type of high density residential units to be able to accommodate that demand. And the other part would be is that, and this is probably the most interesting part, that somehow, Scott, in the communication, that not everybody wants a half acre of ground to live on. Some people, particularly this generation, may be very accustomed to the fact, and there's evidence to support this, they're comfortable that says, I'd love to live in a townhouse. I'd love to live in a condominium. I'd like to go vertical. And if we can provide an educational moment to help them understand that this is the demand and that we stop thinking about the past and start thinking about the future, we can build an infrastructure that will accommodate the demand. Otherwise, this nonsense about not my backyard is just plaguing every small community. And it's not just Roy. It's going to be anybody that basically says, I don't want change. I heard from Tooele. You know, I hate to say this, but the news was pretty radical yesterday about some possible changes to really make some incredible changes out there in Tooele around the LDS temple, they're saying. And there was a big push back, and now they've changed that plan. I think we have got to educate. And so, Scott, communication, in my opinion, is critical. Let's take the issue straight on. Let's address it in terms of we got to address growth. And it's the responsibility of these councils to be responsible for the next 5, 10, and 20 years. They have to do that. That's my own.
So, Mayor, one of the things to add to what you're saying, one of the things that I don't think our residents really understand are those cost of community services models that really show that the amount of tax paid by a residential property, for every dollar they pay, they receive $1.33 in services. And that is really compounded by a large urban sprawl. So, because the farther between residences, the more that disparity happens. So those cost of community services studies that really are the analysis and the technical analysis behind what show that are some of the data that I really think people just don't understand. It's not necessarily intuitive until you switch to the other side of the dais and really start having to manage the budgets. So that could be part of those pieces and getting those, updating those studies. I'd love to see a newer one than what we have for Utah's data and start sharing those with our communities.
I think that Tina is spot on that. And I just wanted to echo what Mayor Dandoy just said as well. One of the things that I find that I think really has to be something that we incorporate moving forward is there is a communications group and we all see each other at various meetings, whether it's WFRC, other types of meetings. So we're all very engaged. Mostly mayors, but there's council in there as well. And I really think that there needs to be a broader, more council-driven incorporation of an education process and a better understanding of how taxes work, how cities structure their budgets, and what that they are looking for in the future, and what growth is anticipated, and how that growth generates. All of these discussions, I think, are fantastic, but I don't know that they always get to those council members who might not be quite as engaged. And I kind of think, you know, when a new council member gets elected, they get a Robert's Rules type of, here's how this works. We get open public meetings, trainings. We don't get, you know, here's how the budgets work. Here's what is projected to happen up to 2050. Those are, I think, education pieces for those elected officials who might not be as engaged that I really think is a critical component that needs to be incorporated in some way. Because without that, I don't know that they will have this more broader understanding, because that's just not, you know, it's just not something that they're seeing every day. Like some of us who are at a lot of these meetings and we're kind of looking at this from this broader perspective.
Thank you, Beth, because that's one of the things that I'm going to bring in a rural perspective on this. One of the things that the legislature just did in expanding economic development grants in rural Utah is require an economic development board be formed. And there is some real wisdom in that that I think could be shared among other entities, even in cities along the Wasatch Front, as we're bringing in members of our community that are required by statute for this board. You're bringing in a business owner, you're bringing in a member of your community, you're bringing in workforce services, and you're bringing in people who will sit on this committee and talk about these very issues. Well, each member of your community who's sitting on that council and is looking at these discussions in a real way has the opportunity to go back out into the community and share what they're learning the same way that we're getting this in the meetings that we're all attending. So I have found I tweaked mine a little bit to require not the appointed, the manager of our local city or our local school district, because I know they get it. They're in those meetings. I would like members of their board, that the school board and that the city council and those members are coming and hearing it firsthand. Sometimes it's so much easier to use an employee or an appointed official because we all have jobs, but without the input from the rest of the community, we don't get this information out.
This is Mayor Arvey, and I have just two comments on it. One, I think there's always a tendency to underestimate the long-term costs in favor of short-term costs. So we need to make sure we educate everyone on what the long-term costs are, and that those in the long term can't be avoided if we do have urban sprawl. I think the other thing that we need to appreciate and understand and probably educate people, everyone on, is that when we do have density, a lot of times it does affect livability issues. And so then the question comes in, is if we're going to allow this density, how do we improve livability? What do we do about parks? What do we do about open space? Are we planning for schools? And if we make sure everyone's educated and we actually come up with plans to address those livability issues, then it's easier to go ahead and address the public's concern about density. But those aren't easy issues. to deal with. What are the long-term plans for our parks? How are we going to deal with overcrowding in schools? And those are issues that are real issues that people want to see addressed. And in all of this, we need to do a better job of making sure that we're planning for those livability issues to make sure that people aren't negatively impacted.
This is Julie Fulmer. I want to build off of what you're saying, because I think part of the education that is lacking sometimes in this conversation is the regional outlook of communities that don't necessarily live along transportation or transit infrastructures, that are having this discussion come to their communities about having to account for smaller lots or density, and their natural instinct is to think that they need connected housing or apartments. And I think that some type of education that explains that in smaller communities that aren't connected to these transportation networks, they're not going to benefit from having apartments or condos in the same way that a city that is on a transportation corridor would. And so the way that they can plan for people to get a start and then raise a family and retire would be more along the lines of just smaller lots. And I think that would help the narrative that's going into council meetings when you're saying, look, we need to accommodate for, we can't just approve 5-acre lots, we need to go down to 1-acre lots in some areas, which seems kind of funny, but that I believe that on a regional scale, that is the type of discussion that isn't necessarily happening. And it's just accounting for places with no backyards and connected and attached living. And I also think if there was education going out there, kind of what Beth Holbrook was saying, just on a stronger perspective of these tax dollars and this funding that goes to these transportation and regional connections only makes sense if there's that overall education that's going out to communities about how ridership or how automobiles and how all of that connects into the growth that's going to be coming in 2050.
Excellent point. I appreciate all of these comments. Scott, as we pivot back to your next part of this, the next item that's on here is the analysis. I'd like to share one of the successes I had in kind of telling this story is when I pulled the data for my community. I pulled the average home price and the average salary, and then how many jobs were in our community, which indicated that 67% of my community is commuting out. And then I turned that back around and I said, based on this data, we would have to lower the average home price in our community by $123,000 for someone who lives in my community to work in my community. And that kind of data is shocking to people and it gets their attention very quickly, but it's data that we don't necessarily have or put together and share with our residents. So as we look at that, those resources that really can be, that can come together and the numbers can tell a story quicker than we can. Scott, I'd like to turn it back to you.
This is Kendall Thomas out in Tulare County. There's a couple issues we struggle with. And of course, it's already been mentioned about the pulling back of the new temple that was going to be built out here. Some people are confused about affordability of housing and the shortage of housing. And Tulare County has grown like many places in Utah. But our biggest problem is people acknowledge we're going to grow. But here we are dumping all these new developments onto an already overloaded Highway 36, onto a freeway system that state highways, not federal highways. We can't handle it now. And they're saying, Commissioner, why are you approving all these additional new houses, all these new developments, when we can't move these folks in and out? The majority of our people work in Salt Lake Valley. So we kind of got affordable housing, shortage of housing, a transportation that's already burdened. And so that's the issues we struggle with, is communicating to these people. And they say, well, we understand we're going to grow, but what about the dang Highway 36? How are you getting on these freeways? So that's some real issues that we try to communicate to, but we don't have any really good answers.
Well, and I share your concerns on it, Commissioner, because we face the same thing in the outlying communities in having so much of our population commuting in. But one of the flip side of having affordable housing in your community, the other answer is, if you don't want them to commute out for work, what are the resources that have to exist in your community for them to be able to work in your community? Because I pointed out, based on our income levels, that would mean we would need an influx of high class, or I'm not going to use the right word, but class A office space is the word I'm looking for. And that we don't have class A office space within our community for them to work in our community. But that, so it approaches the issue from the other side as well, that look, for you to work here, these are the things you need to work here. We can concentrate on both of these problems, or we can ignore one, or we can ignore both, but they're still going to exist. So pointing out the data helps on both sides of it, what it takes to be able to work inside your own community and what it takes to be able to afford to live in your own, where your job is. So any other comments before we move back to Scott?
Can I make a quick comment? This is Amy Winder-Newton.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think these are really great conversations, and we definitely do need to help educate the public on this. You know, what I'm seeing in my community is a lot of frustration that we don't have the infrastructure. And so when they hear about higher density, you know, they get really frustrated with that. And so getting the infrastructure in place is such a key component of getting them to buy into this kind of thing. The other thing too, that I think we have to be aware of is, you know, everybody talks about high density and that's the answer. Well, what I'm seeing both personally with one of my newly married sons, but also within our community, is that people are moving into townhomes and other high density areas, but then they quickly want to transition to single family homes. I've got a son with two dogs now, and he wants a backyard for them to run around in. And so, you know, if we don't keep on top of single family home development, and the Board of Realtors has great numbers on this, there's demand there too. Then people, if they don't move up into those and then free up some of the lower priced housing, we still are going to be challenged. And so I think we just need to recognize there still needs to be a mix of housing types. We can't just think high density is going to solve all our problems.
I think you're absolutely right. And that is also one of the items that we should be looking at as far as the impacts of COVID. As we look at this, when people can commute to their work, don't need to go into the office. Hey, I got parking in the building today. I know you're all jealous, but on the first level at WFRC, because there just isn't the commute in that there used to be. So if you can work from anywhere, do you want to be in a tighter community, or do you want to be able to breathe, to have a backyard? Are we moving the other direction? The other part of this, going back to some of the comments shared before, is we talked about the younger generation wanted to be able to spend money on experiences, that was eating out and travel. We're not able to do those as much as we used to anymore. With that switch, do we go back to that normal, or are we switching that to being they want to live where they can go recreate in the outdoors and then come back to the office? Are we going to be moving to a natural community of interaction with people who live and work in the same type of industry? So where you're not socializing in the office, you are socializing in your community in an outdoor meeting on a river or something more. So really, I think we're just starting to explore what the impacts of this are, but I think as leaders in our community, we have to be keeping all of these things in mind and making those adjustments so that we're adjusting as society adjusts, and we're helping our communities adjust to a new normal or a new demand for a different service.
Yeah, this is Mayor Arvey again, and it's just something that I wonder about, and that is it really feasible and something that we want to have and encourage urban sprawl? Density has its benefits, and if we want to go ahead and continue and encourage or allow a bunch of, quarter acre lots or whatever, where do we put them? How do we get the water? We are geographically constrained. And so I think, especially as a planning group, we need to look at and say, what kind of housing can we really have for all of these residents that are coming in? And how do we make that housing livable? I don't think that the quarter acre lot is something that we can really encourage and really have with our water resources and the land resources that we currently have.
So I understand exactly where you're coming from, because in rural Utah, we know where they're coming and where they're going to go. And it does, for a community who would prefer that they be 20 acre lots, quarter acre lots seem way too small. But it is an interesting perspective, and that is the challenge of this group as we are talking about what the different demands are and what the global outlook is. But we have to keep in mind that regardless of what we want people to want, there is still a market, and you still have to adjust to the needs of the market. And those things are really in flux. So any other comments? This is a great discussion that we're having. All right, Scott, can we turn it back to you for the analysis section of this?
Yep, I will. I'm going to push through, and thank you very much for those comments. I was writing notes the whole time during that discussion. We can bring those items back. One thing to note, just so that you know where the frame of reference is that these resources are coming from, is that they're really driven towards citizen planners. So your planning commissioners, your city councilors, elected officials at the local level, they might not be that second tier communication resource. So we're going to rely on those folks. We'll provide resources, provide the education that they're asking for, and then hope that those community leaders go out into the public and prepare that communication one level down, specifically to the general public. So just as you're thinking about the way these resources are being framed, that's kind of our target audience. I was going to address the public engagement group. I'm going to actually push through that to the analysis group and just talk about the first item. So the analysis group has four key objectives, but one that I wanted to hit was this, the statewide progress monitoring that include health inequity and access to opportunity. So I'll quickly discuss ATO, the access to opportunities. And the goal is to increase the usability of this data that we have around access to opportunities by improving understanding of how to use it at various scales. So the access to opportunities data provides an
Scott,
assessment.
Scott, would you mind remind us what access to opportunities is?
Yep, so access to opportunities is the ability of a person, and it's really any person. It's not the vulnerable populations or anyone along a transit line. It's the ability of any one person to access things like schools, jobs, broader educational resources, hospitals. It can be grocery stores, parks and rec, general open spaces. So it's really, you can pinpoint around the region through this data, and it's in this location, this person has accessibility of these types of housing options and these types of job opportunities and these educational resources. And you can figure out with this data where in your community you may want to focus on improving job opportunities. And that can come through a number of ways. So you can improve the accessibility of a person to get to new jobs by making transportation choices more available or transportation faster. So that could come with investments in rail transport and bus rapid transit, or even road widenings or bridge, point projects that accommodate. So we're tying together the critical function of what the Metropolitan Planning Organization does, one of them, the Regional Transportation Plan, with this broader question of land use, livability, and how people are actually accessing things like jobs and education resources. So the access to opportunity provides an assessment of the transportation system and where households and employment is located. And I think we all feel the data is critical to understanding people's ability to access what they need. So this is one of those key components of, we have the data, we have maps, but how do we make it more usable? How do we get it into the hands of Planning Commission members? How do we tie it to the legislation for Senate Bill 34 for the expanded elements of your general plan in order to make sure that cities know, you know, what they need to do to tie socioeconomic data with their transportation plan and link that with their newly updated moderate income housing plans, and be sure that we're using the data to expand what we're calling access to opportunities, which is really the quality, you know, it's a major quality of life thing for the region. And we understand that not everybody across this entire swath of land, you know, the area that WFRC covers is Brigham City to Bluffdale. We know not everybody will have the same access to opportunities, but everybody will have areas in their community that they could begin to focus on improving the number of households that are in this area, or increasing the number of job opportunities for any one household in these areas. And looking at the data and objectively being able to make those decisions will be critical. And that's one of the key statewide data measures that we're going to continue to work on. So with the short time, I just wanted to hit that, ask if there are any questions specifically around ATO or these other data resources that the analytics group is going to look at. Happy to field those. And otherwise, this has been a very helpful conversation for us, and we'll take this information back to the working groups.
Councilmember Cannon, can I pose a question? So this concept of statewide measures of progress, this is this basic idea of just understanding, hey, let's say we have plans and we have visions. We have the regional transportation plan. We have Utah's unified transportation plan. We have Wasatch Choice 2050. But how are we doing today on the ground in terms of congestion, the ability to get to destinations, air quality, housing affordability, and do we understand that perhaps even on a community by community basis, where decision makers can think about, well, okay, I have a sense of how we're doing as a community, and we can think about whether or not we want to shift course. And I'm backing up in order to ask the question, are there key things that you think would be really important for us as the Wasatch Choice partners to focus on in the provision of data about progress across the greater metropolitan area?
Scott?
Or that's to everybody, and hopefully that came across clearly as a question, but I think if there was even just like a brainstorming of this issue, that issue, this goal, whatever it might be, we can also take those comments in the chat bar, and afterward you can send them to Scott Hess, myself, Katie Girard. Any of those are helpful. I will just note that Our basic intention is to think about the goals that are part of the Utah's transportation vision, the goals that are part of Wasatch Choice 2050, and to provide some measures of how well are we doing across Utah on those kinds of metrics.
Beth, I think this is a really good transition into some of the items that were discussed at JPAC. And what we're seeing, the impacts on transportation based on COVID, what the ridership is, what the level of commuter traffic has been affected, and if we're seeing a rebound on that, and what's really happening on the ground now is helpful information to be shared amongst this group and then amongst all the members of WFRC.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tina. I would agree with that. I think part of the overall education piece is just getting everyone to understand kind of some of the short-term impacts versus what we're seeing and the long-term perspective. So I'm just going to go over it really quick, but if I'm going too long, just let me know. So obviously during the initial COVID shutdown response, we saw a dramatic decline in ridership, upwards of about 80%, roughly, overall. That wasn't across the board. The commuter front runner was the most challenging, and then buses were the most utilized service during even during the peak COVID hours. And one of the things that really struck me is that even during the height of our complete shutdown in mid-March through April, we were still transporting 41,000 people a day. And those were people that had limited other transportation options, and they were riding transit. And we were working to make sure that we could manage the people that are gonna get onto that space. And so we implemented the sanitizing rules that we established. We put social distancing signs up first. We also incorporated masks and hand sanitizer stations on each vehicle, whether it's a bus, front runner, train car, tracks train car. And we also implemented more long-term strategies. We received $187 million through the CARES Act directly to the transit system, or directly to our transit agency. And we're using some of that money to replace cloth seats in the track system. We're gonna replace all of them eventually, because plastic is obviously easier to sanitize. And we're putting up operator shields to minimize impacts until we get some type of an immunization / vaccine scenario involved. We anticipate this is gonna be long-term. We are seeing an increase, an uptick back to normal. And as a result of that, we are implementing our new bus service schedule August 23rd, so coming up really soon, just in time for the universities to go back to school in whatever format that they are going back. We are basically restoring 91% of our service. So we did cut back in April as a result of the dramatic decline, but we're restoring 91% of our service. In some places, we're actually increasing the amount of service because we're seeing people continuing to use that. And structurally, it's people have asked this question, how does, it seems like transit would be this really challenging thing during a COVID environment. And we actually have not seen any outbreaks associated with our system at all. We really jumped into making sure that whatever systems we were doing for sanitizing, we had to increase them. We had to change the structures. We had to encourage rear bus boardings, whatever we could do to do that. And the education piece has been constant with what we're doing, and we know we have a lot more of education because it has to be continually out there. We did create a recovery web link on our website. It's rideuta.com/recovery to allow people to access all the data. So we have data on our finances, so the receiving of the CARES Act money and what we're doing with that. The ridership totals, that's updated about weekly. So we were down to 41,000 at the height, and now we're back up about, I think roughly in the 56,000 riders per day category. And we know that this is an ongoing thing. Now, long-term, we still have strategic growth questions, and we're really trying to work with the communities to incorporate some of this input that we're getting, which is still, how do we deal with growth? And we get asked this a lot, UTA, are we gonna expand service here? What is this going to look like long-term? So we're really trying to incorporate all of that and incorporate what we continue to see as our new normal. None of the things that I talked about just now are going to change, even if there is a vaccine, because we feel like this is what we are learning from this situation, is that we have to be part of the solution to making sure that people feel safe riding transit. And that's a very visual, it's very personal. Some people are sending their children back to colleges or sending them to college for the first time. And others are like, I'm not sure what I want to do. And so we have to address that short term and then long term with the growth. And I hope this is answering your question or your comment, Tina. And if there's anything else, I'd be happy to delve into it further. I know we have limited time, but it really is key And I will stress the education piece again and again, because I feel like there's not an opportunity to say, oh, I put it out there, I'm done. I think a website is great. And I am really, we've even gotten national recognition on our website because we put it out so quickly that, you know, even nationally, it's, wow, kudos to UTA. But it's not enough. You have to continue to have these education dialogues. You have to continue to help people understand that even though ridership is down right now, and it is down, especially the teleworking piece, we don't know how that's going to shape any of our dialogues moving forward. But structurally, transit is still in a good space because we have a geographically limited area. That is not going to change. The number of business communications are still saying Utah is number one in economic growth, recovery, all of these elements. That means that more people are going to be attracted to having a location to live in. And so we anticipate continued growth. We are still having children. We anticipate that level of continued growth. And that's what we're trying to help manage and help the communities that we service and then help them to understand that. One of the things that we get a lot of questions on all the time is, can I do a transit-oriented development in my community? And the answer, of course, is yes. Now, we had the cap eliminated from the last legislative session, and this has increased the dialogue. People ask me all the time, well, I guess there's not going to be any more retail space, there's not going to be any more commercial space or office space, and that is not structurally what we are seeing. People are looking at it and maybe putting off some of their investments in office and retail, but they're not discounting it, I should say. And there's a lot of elements that I think long-term, we still have to be engaging in these analyses and these planning exercises to make sure that we are in a space where we can help to alleviate what we anticipate will be long-term growth pressures.
Thank you. That does answer the question. It reminded me of one of two things. Andrew is missing today because he is taking his son in to the dorms for the first time. Andrew will be an empty nester. Our hearts all go out to him in both celebration and sadness. It's a mix. And he will be riding those buses that Beth talked about as kids go back to school. So I appreciate that. The other thing I wanted to bring out is where this COVID impact, we've kind of merged items 3 and 4. So one of the things that I was hearing about in an economic podcast, because I'm a nerd and I listen to them, was that as people are able to choose where they live, they're choosing an area where they can travel after work, where the recreational opportunities are available closer to home. Utah fits into that model in multiple ways now, especially in the tech community, where we may see a decrease in people able to go or who can work from home, especially where we are so focused on tech in Utah. But what we're also seeing is an increase in people wanting to live here if they can live anywhere, because we are so close to so many incredible natural resources. Because international travel has become very difficult and up and down and unable to plan, road trips are becoming more and more. You're seeing the camping and recreating in great outdoors become more and more popular. One of my businesses told me last night, he was the business of the year for the Business Resource Center, that he was travel. And he took a 90% hit in the first month of COVID. But he pivoted very quickly because that's the entrepreneur that he is. And he turned those employees into people who were actually outfitting canoes. Now, I didn't know there was a market for that, let alone a way to make a business model out of it. But that's really where we're seeing some of these impacts really hit. But in acknowledging all of that is a different workforce that is able to choose to work from home. Those who are required to go into work in a manufacturing environment are still those who will be using transit. So it is important to keep that planning going forward and acknowledging those realities in an economy that is addressing all of the different types of workforce that we have here and the resources that we have. So Ted, I'm going to turn that back over to you if you have anything you wanted to add or any other.
No, I thank you, council member. I don't have anything more to add on this one. I could provide some introductory comments on our next agenda item if that's appropriate.
Yeah, please.
And our next agenda item is addressing COVID-19 and other uncertainties in Wasatch Choice. And I just wanted to note that broadly speaking, there are two major things that staff is working on, taking direction from Council and Regional Growth Committee. And those two things are, one, how can we help implement Wasatch Choice transportation and help local governments in the work that they do? That's one, and we just had that conversation. And the second is related, but how do we address the uncertainties that come with COVID-19 as well as autonomous vehicles and shared mobility and e-living? These kinds of things that are shifting the landscape of how people live and work that affect transportation and land development. So those are our two major threads. And that's this second agenda item. I just wanted to take a step back and note that we're doing those two major threads based on the direction that we have heard from both of you. And I last thing I'll say is we're cognizant of that, of the fact that, you know, communities are in the middle of the storm right now. And I imagine that many of you are coming to this meeting and you're feeling like we're in the middle of the storm dealing with COVID-19, and we come to this conversation with WFRC and now we're looking out ahead a number of years. I can imagine that that might provide a little bit of a whiplash, if you will, in perspectives. But we will all, I think, emerge out of COVID-19, and the growth pressures will still be there. And that's part of the rationale for just thinking about, well, how do we be prepared to help communities, transportation agencies re-engage in those implementation conversations as we emerge from that? So those are a couple of introductory comments, council member.
All right, I feel like you've heard a lot from me today. And any comments from the rest of the group?
And then Julie, your status.
All right, seeing none, I do see Julie on the screen. So I'm gonna turn the time over to you, Julie. Hey, Jim, get off your phone and pay attention.
Julie, are you muted?
I was paying so much attention, I forgot to unmute myself. Can you see the presentation? Okay.
Yes.
All right, so thanks, Tina and Ted. This year at RGC meetings, we have been discussing the overall strategy of the 2023 Regional Transportation Plan and also provided some initial COVID-19 impacts. Now we're back to give an update on our progress over the last few months. As a reminder, the Wasatch Choice is a vision for the future. It's composed of local land use as defined by our local communities and of regional transportation. So today I'm going to focus on that regional transportation component and more specifically on uncertainties. As you're painfully aware, we're living through some uncertainties now, like COVID-19, but also with other technologies that are impacting our future. A few years ago, the president of GM said, we think that there's going to be more change in the world of mobility over the next 5 years than there's been in the last 50 years. And we at WFRC think that this trend is continuing. So the transportation component of the Wasatch Choice is the Regional Transportation Plan. The development of the 2023 to 2050 Regional Transportation Plan is composed of three key stages. First, we've been spending this year understanding the uncertainty of the future, looking at external forces and policies and how they impact travel demand, land use, and economic development. And this will feed into our work next year on developing scenarios to test how these external forces may impact our region. Through these regional scenarios, we'll work with our communities, our transportation agencies, stakeholders, and the public to identify projects to test and to move forward into a preferred scenario. And then in the last year and a half of the plan, we'll focus on phasing and financially constraining that preferred list of projects and developing policies and other implementation tools that can help our communities move the plan forward into reality. So we are beginning this plan by exploring external forces, namely impact from COVID-19, automation, like connected and autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars, which may increase capacity of our roadway system, but which also may increase our vehicle miles traveled. And then in addition to that, looking at high-tech transit systems. Also shared mobility, like on-demand travel and sharing services, bike share, scooter share, which have existed for only a few years, but which may replace transit trips or may complement transit by providing a first mile, last mile solution. And then our last big external force is the concept of e-living, like online shopping and telecommuting, which can impact not only how we use retail and office space, but may change our land uses and our parking needs. So at the beginning of summer, we met with peer groups for transit, roadways, active transportation in local communities. And we talked with city and county and transportation agency staff around, as well as stakeholders from around the state to really understand how people foresaw these external forces affecting them and what kind of, what the range of implementation we might be seeing in the next 10, 20, and 30 years. We'll do a similar, more detailed process exploring policies early next year. So those policies might include managed lanes and fare-free transit, which can help complement our investments in transportation. This year, we would like to elevate the conversation about the importance of looking at these forces because they really affect people's lives and transportation. And we thought a great way to do that is to tell the story of places, households, and firms in the future through this concept of sketched narratives by asking the question, what is life like in 2035? And by asking this question, we can better inform our planning efforts by understanding the cumulative impact of these forces. So not only how does autonomous vehicles affect our community, but autonomous vehicles and telecommuting and more online shopping. So to illustrate what we're doing, we wanted to see how this might play out in real families. And these families could be you or someone you know. So we developed the concept of the Conrads and the Terrys. The Conrads are a white collar family in which both heads of households work in an office setting. And the Terrys are a blue-collar family in which there are two working-class incomes. And so, for example, we can see that the Conrads might be able to telework, and they might be well-off enough to afford an autonomous vehicle. And if they can do these two things, then they might commute less. And when they do need to commute, they can work while traveling to the office. This allows them more freedom in choosing where they live because distance to work and commute times play a less significant role, if any, in their choice of housing. However, this could also impact our region by dispersing housing even more if people start looking for housing that can accommodate offices within the home. Personally, the Conrads are saving money because they're commuting less and they potentially have less housing costs. And their quality of life has increased as they have more free time and are able to walk and bike more, which are habits they acquired during COVID-19 and their city did a safe streets program. So they were able to pause their telework and get out more often. On the other hand are the Terrys, and they might not be able to telework or afford an autonomous vehicle. So they're still commuting daily, and so they don't get the same financial and free time benefits as the Conrads. Unfortunately, they might be relying on transit service, which might be reduced due to fewer peak period commuters. And thus the Terrys are unable to shed a vehicle and their housing choices are somewhat tied to their job locations. In addition, they might be worried about their jobs moving to areas of the region where land is less expensive, which might make their commute longer, again, impacting their free time. And they're worried about their jobs being replaced due to automation. So this is sort of like a high level overview of how we're trying to frame our thinking when we discuss how these forces impact households around the region over the next 15 years. And we're developing a more detailed narrative that take a broader look at all of the different forces I mentioned earlier, not just for the households, but also for places in general, and then two firms, a typical office-based firm and a retail-based firm. So now that you're somewhat familiar with our approach, we'd like to just get your initial reaction. How do you think these forces, COVID-19, automation, shared mobility, e-living, will affect you and your family, your business, your neighborhood over the next 15 years? And if you guys don't come up with anything, I have four prompts that I'm willing to ask you questions for. So does anyone have any initial reaction to whether we're getting it right with how these forces are affecting us, or have any other input? Or I'm going to my prompts.
I can add to that. I think really what we're seeing is there's a lot of discussion over what the normal looks like as we come out of this, and do we all go back to what was normal? But I think the difference in the conversation that we're having now is that the bandwidth, the connectivity issue. We've never seen this type of ability to work from home, to find the productivity from working from home. And so I think you're starting to see a shift like we haven't seen before. So.
Yeah, and we anticipate that being one of the major major influences of how our households and our communities change into the future. With less people commuting, does that mean, how does that impact traffic? How does that impact our urban cores? Does that mean that our office spaces are reduced, that typical downtowns maybe don't have as much retail or as much restaurant? Do office spaces get converted into residential uses? On the other hand, and Ted will talk about this in a second, there's the concept of the great localization. The more time we spend in our community, if we're teleworking, the more we want around us in our community. I know for myself, I live in a pretty walkable area, but with COVID, a lot of the restaurants have been closed or are just takeout. And I'm really ready to get back to an afternoon walk to a restaurant for lunch, or afternoon walk with my son to get ice cream, or just something in the neighborhood. So we're sort of weighing how are these influences affecting our communities? Are they making us more dispersed, or in some ways are they making us more centered? So are you seeing in your community any land use changing as retail is transforming, changes in parking or curbside management? Especially with COVID-19, are you seeing more people engaged in active transportation?
Julie, this is Beth Holbrook. One of the things that we are seeing, which was almost immediate, is that the times, and obviously this has a lot to do with teleworking, but even in the immediacy of shutdown during April, we noticed that the utilization of our buses was different. There was not this morning, afternoon peaks as we had typically framed them. And instead, what we were seeing is people, and this is just obviously speculative, but we did do some studies, but they mostly asked about when people thought they were going to go back to work. But we noticed that there is this peak in utilization during the 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. So completely different than what we would normally anticipate. And we thought it was people getting out. They were teleworking, or they were doing something else, or their schedules had changed significantly enough that they were now using the service during a different timeline altogether. And we recognize that immediate teleworking, there's no longer this commute, there's no longer the connectivity of the buses from our frontrunner stations, right? But also, we're still seeing that. We're still seeing different times of utilization increases that has, it's just one of those things that at this stage we just look at and note, but we don't know what that will portend in the future.
Yes, Julie, yeah. This is Kendall Ottentwill again. The big difference we've seen is since COVID hit is traffic congestion at these pinch points that gain access to go onto the interstate is reduced amazingly, because hopefully people are working from home instead of being laid off. But that's been a huge impact to us. And if we can develop commercial out here in the county, I think it'll take a lot of load off. And I'm sure there's going to be people working from home going into the future. So that's a big impact at Twilla.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at something similar in Morgan County. The sales tax or the sales revenue in Morgan City has increased 100% over last year at the same time. And it's that same reason, because people, especially in Morgan City, are now, they're not commuting. down to Weber and Davis counties to pick up their groceries there, and they're spending more money in Morgan City at that grocery store and at the hardware store within the city. I don't know, Tina, if you've seen that, but that seems to agree with Ty and Mayor Little. But that's definitely happening in Morgan County.
And the other big impact that we're seeing out there, because so much of our sales tax is dependent on the automotive dealership and the lower, on a purchase of a major vehicle that pulls an RV that allows people to go camping has been very, very popular. So yeah, we were seeing that same spike.
Well, maybe that's a good transition over to Ted to talk about the great localization of our activity.
Thanks, Julie. The idea here is to just give you some of the latest data about COVID-19 and how it is affecting transportation behavior. But Julie mentioned this. If you think about it, when people commuted to an office location, they didn't hole up inside their office the whole day. They would go out at lunch. They would walk around, perhaps go to a plaza. Now, all of those demands for interacting with your office community and the demands that you have for interacting with your neighborhood are combined into one place. And this is shown by Julie, advance it one little click, by this, anyway, the adorable combining of the two circles. So your demands for what you're looking for are in your office environment and your work environment are now in the same place. And so let's look at the data kind of within that perspective. Go to the next slide, if you would. These are August numbers. So these are brand new, and they contrast what we see now versus what we saw before COVID-19. These are Utah numbers. Retail trips down, we expect that. Workplace trips are still down 40%. That peaked at about 40% in May, and it has stayed there, which is very significant. Transit trips, we know those are down now, Trustee Holbrook talked about them. Bicycle trips spiked really high, but they've stayed up about 40%. Open space trips are just off the charts. Trips is a surrogate for demand and for use. This adds up to freeway volumes down approximately, it does vary based on the part of the state or the freeway, very roughly 10%. You might think of that as not a significant number. It still is a very significant number. It's a hard thing to do to reduce volumes on freeways for a variety of reasons, but this adds up to approximately a 10% reduction in air emissions. So this is kind of where we're at. If you go to the next slide, I just wanted to note, like, if we think about all of the demands that a person has that's teleworking now, you know, if their home is where the heart is, and they're spending so much time in their home, and you reflect on the data that we just saw, they want more now than ever a park that they can get to quickly. Places that, let's say, post-COVID, when the demands for social distancing are lower, destinations that they can get to, a gym, restaurants, a pharmacy, and they're going to have their bike right there with them. We know that bicycle usage is up 40%. There's a demand for these kinds of things to be localized, at least for a portion of the population, at least for a portion of those people that are teleworking. And I think it's really a policy fork in the road for communities where we can think about, well, are we competing to be attractive for the teleworker by meeting their wants and needs for open space, nearby destinations, and the ability to get there using bicycling? This is reflected in the data that I just showed you. The contrast is if communities are not attractive for that teleworking set of demands, the other teleworking set of demands are, I want to save money. I want to save money on my housing. And Julie talked about this, that we may see a significant dispersion of housing from the growth in telework over time. So this is a really important policy question for us as local governments, and it has regional transportation implications. If you would go to the next slide. This is part of the story of what we have been talking about already over the last few years with Wasatch Choice. These yellow and orange polygons represent those centers of communities, those walkable places that allow a concentration of destinations near lower density single family neighborhoods that may surround them. And I think it fits in nicely with this concept of great localization. So we don't have to look too far afield. It resonates, I think, with the with our shared Wasatch Choice 2050 vision. I wanted to provide that reflection of this concept of a great localization, and then one more reflection, and then I will, Council Member, I'll turn it back to you to see if there's any questions before our last agenda item. These are postulates, which is a fancy way of saying, we don't know. But if you look ahead to perhaps 2 years after COVID-19, where might we be? And there's been so much practice and refinement in the process of telework that I think perhaps a good faith estimate is that we'll see somewhere between half or a fourth of the level of telework that we see right now still in place even after COVID-19 subsides. And then go ahead and bring up these arrows, Julie, just to get to my final point before I wrap up. A lot of the question, look at the freeway volumes and air emissions at the bottom of this slide. There is a lot of uncertainty about whether we hold on to a reduction of freeway volumes that stem from the good things that we're experiencing now, telework, bicycle usage, or whether it goes the other direction and we actually see a jump in freeway volumes. Why would there be such a disparity, negative 10 to plus 10? It really, I think, comes down to the story of what happens with public transportation. I think part of the reason why, reflect on this, we're seeing negative 40%, or 40% of our workplace trips have been diverted to largely telework currently. And yet we only see a 10% reduction in freeway volumes. And part of the story there is that transit is not carrying the load that it has in the past. If transit rebounds, let's say transit does about what it did before COVID-19, then we may be able to hang on to a reduction of negative 10%, let's say, in freeway volumes. If transit doesn't rebound, and we don't help it rebound, then we might see that we lose those gains in terms of air quality and freeway volumes. And I wanted to just leave that with you. Transit is really important to our story of how we rebound from COVID-19. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Council Member, in case there's any questions on these thought pieces and the data for August relative to COVID-19.
So I'm going to send that out to the group. Are there any comments or questions on this particular data?
Yeah, this is Reed. Hi, Ted. I had a sense that the walk mode share was, or at least the amount of walking frequency was way up initially, and it seems to have been leveling off a little bit. Do you have numbers on walking as a mode of either recreation or transportation?
I have an intuitive idea that as heat rises, walking decreases. That's just me. Anyone who has actual data can add down.
Reed, I don't have those at my fingertips. We have location by location counts. for walking, but we don't have, I think, a great sense of what's happening system-wide on that mode. And maybe we can chat offline and think about sources of data that might shed light on that question.
Well, cell phone data, we have in the study that all of you will be receiving, I've sent it on, and it will, we're looking at how COVID-19 rates of infection and rates of death are affected by both metropolitan area size and also by density. But we have a sense that and data behind it, cell phone data, that people were staying within a mile of their home in very large numbers, not necessarily staying home, that is sheltering in place, but staying close to home in very large numbers. And those large numbers suggest walk trips, at least to me. So you're right about the heat. You know, we've been taking our dogs out, and they're going on strike when we go on our walks now because it's so hot. But I do think that this, you know, the walk mode, I believe I've ever said this in one of our meetings in the years I've been on the Regional Growth Committee, but the walk mode is far and away the second most common mode of transportation. It's 10 times as much walking as biking, 3 times as much walking as transit. And so we really do want in these comparisons to do whatever we can with cell phone data or whatever to capture the walk mode as an alternative to driving.
Thank you. I appreciate all the data that you bring, Reid. I really do, because it's fascinating to me. And in a call I was on last Friday, the question was thrown out over how it's impacting different levels of elevation because of the different numbers that are coming in from Ridge County versus St. George in Washington County. And maybe there are some aspects of this that we're not quite aware of yet. So the data is really fascinating to me on interpreting where this will go. As a closing comment, before we move on to our last agenda item, I would like to throw one thing out there, that as we go back into schools opening, I think we all need to be aware of that there is still a disproportionate impact on women in the workforce when we talk about COVID-19 and the impacts, especially when we talk about what happens if schools shut down and there is learning, distance learning from home. Overwhelmingly, it is the female member of the household who will then adjust their work schedule and their availability in order to provide those education needs for a child that is learning from home. That makes it very difficult for her to be able to fulfill her commitments to work. So, and office, and be there and be all things to all people. I'm really seeing this impact, especially in my own community and women who are not able to fulfill their work commitments. We need to be aware of this going forward. There needs to be some flexibility. This conversation needs to start happening, especially if we go into additional lockdowns. So I'm going to end it on that comment. That's my editorial comment for the day. And we'll move into our overview of WFRC available funds and programs. We're going to give WFRC administers 6 programs that provide resources for local governments totaling approximately $40 million annually. And we're going to get a rapid fire presentation, 1 minute per funding source. So,
Scott,
it's all yours.
All right, wonderful. And thank you, Katie, again for sharing this. And sorry that you get me twice today, but we're going to break this up this time. So as you just said, we have 6 funding programs The information will include application deadlines, and that will be emailed out later this month. And in case you're unsure what program best fits your project, just feel free to reach out to any of the program leads identified or any of the staff at WFRC, and we'll make sure that you get to the right information. So these are the six programs that we'll run through. First is the Economic Development District. The Wasatch Front EDD is a federally recognized economic development district. It operates within Wasatch Front Regional Council. The mission is to support economic development efforts, promote long-term economic competitiveness, and attract federal monies to implement local plans. District's made up of a 12-member governing board and 13-member strategy committee who put together a regional economic development plan. The Wasatch Front Economic Development District is really the foot in the door for our five-county region to access U.S. Economic Development Administration funding. And examples of those types of projects are shown on the screen. So as you can see, they range from planning to construction to workforce training with amounts that vary almost as much from approximately $100,000 to $2 million. Next slide. This slide highlights actually three of the EDA's funding programs that you can access. These are the pots of money that applicants can apply to. And under each of these program names, the amount of funding that can be awarded up to for those types of projects. These funds are a little bit different than the rest of WFRC's because they're actually available on a rolling annual basis. And our staff, along with EDA, would love to have a conversation with local governments at any time, not just during this project cultivation time for WFRC, to talk with any of our communities about their ideas. The program lead for this program is myself, Scott Hess. If you have any questions, please feel free to give me a call. Next slide. The Transportation Land Use Connection Program is our planning technical assistance program, helping communities achieve their community aspirations and implement the Wasatch Choice Regional Vision. This is a partnership program with UDOT, UTA, Salt Lake County. There's approximately $1.5 million in annual funding for TLC. The program goals are maximizing value of investment in public infrastructure, enhancing access to opportunities, increasing travel options to optimize mobility, and creating communities with opportunities to live, work, and play. Next slide. TLC meets communities where they are and helps them work through the steps towards implementation of their plans. So TLC funds things like plans, policies, and helps with final implementation on the ground, as well as providing funding for supporting studies and analysis along the way. If you have any project ideas you'd like to discuss, the program lead for TLC is Megan Townsend or any of our TLC staff, and feel free to reach out to her. The next program is actually three. It's our federal funding programs, and those are made up of the Surface Transportation Program, STP, Congestion Mitigation Air Quality, CMAQ, and Transportation Alternatives Program, TAP. Next slide. So the STP funds are apportioned to WFRC every year in the amounts of approximately $20 million for the Salt Lake West Valley urban area and $10.7 million for the Ogden-Layton urbanized area. Next slide. The STP eligible project types can fund federal aid eligible facilities, which are collectors, arterials, highways, or freeways. And these funds can construct new roads or widen existing facilities, reconstruct existing facilities, improve roadway operations, and implement transit improvements. Next slide. This is an example project, 5600 West between 6200 South and 7000 South. It was previously a narrow two-lane road with some shoulder, sidewalk, curb and gutter on the east side only. And with STP funds, the project sponsor was able to widen the project to four lanes of traffic, center turn lane, bicycle lane, shoulder, curb, gutter, and sidewalk with lighting on both sides of the road. Next slide. The Congestion Mitigation Air Quality Program, those funds are apportioned to WFRC in the amounts approximately $5.6 million for the Salt Lake West Valley urban area and $3 million for the Ogden-Layton urbanized area. Next slide. And these funds can be used on projects that improve air quality. So they can expand public transportation facilities and equipment, do diesel engine retrofits, idle reduction, emissions programs, and alternative fuels and vehicles. They can also improve traffic flow or operations on the road, such as intersection improvements and bike and ped facilities, as long as they show an air quality benefit to the region. Next slide. So CMAQ project examples. These are examples of past CMAQ projects along the Wasatch Front. We've done a lot of work with UTA. We've done signal timing. We've funded a number of bicycle and pedestrian facilities and UDOT's connected intelligent transportation system. Next slide. The Transportation Alternatives Program funds are apportioned to WFRC every year in the amounts of about $900,000 for Salt Lake West Valley and $500,000 for the Ogden-Layton urban area. Next slide. These funds are able to be used on a variety of activities related to improving transportation assets, including on and off road, pedestrian and bicycle facilities, environmental mitigation, creating or improving recreational trails projects, and this includes our Safe Routes to School funding. Next program. A good example of a TAP project that's a regional trail project highlighting recreational and commuter use is the Denver Rio Grande Rail Trail that runs through Davis and Weber counties and ultimately connects to Jordan River and the broader trail network that we call the Golden Spoke. Next slide. So we're right here in the process. The funding program deadlines, selecting eligible products takes place every year. We initiate the process by asking for letters of intent in August, which will be due at the end of September. In October, we'll request that sponsors prepare and submit a project evaluation concept report or application, depending on what program it is, which is due back to WFRC by the middle of December. And then during the spring of 2021, project recommendations are presented to the various committees and boards for approval. Next slide. So the contacts for those groups are on this slide. We'll be sending this information out. The one program we did not discuss is the Community Development Block Grant Program. That one has limited accessibility to our 5-county region, and that's where Christy Dahlberg is the program manager there. But again, if you're interested, please feel free to reach out to any of us. Another quick note is that the staff of WFRC, especially the TLC folks, are going to be reaching out to your local communities one by one to talk about project cultivation and project ideas you have. Just because we are in the era of COVID, there have been fewer opportunities over the last few months to just meet and greet with you all and have those conversations. So be expecting a call, and absolutely feel free to reach out to any of us if you have any questions, comments, or you'd like to float a project idea across.
Any questions? Do a quick interjection on this.
Sure.
I just want to note that you do not have to remember these six programs. So if you're thinking, I have this idea in my community, and you're wondering whether WFRC and the partners we work with can help, then just fill out an easy letter of intent and submit it in September, and you don't have to know the programs at all. So that's the easy button. Just get your idea out, and then we'll work with you after that.
Fantastic. All right, so that is our final agenda item today is for other business. Any other business, Ted?
Really quick scheduling point is that these things are going to come to a head, this implementation conversation and data on uncertainties, analytics, presented at the League of Cities and Towns Conference, which is now September 21 through September 24th, that whole week. And then that, after that kickoff, if you will, then we're going to have Wasatch Choice workshops that will focus on transportation as well as community development implementation questions and data on uncertainty. So a lot of this kind of stuff, but focused in on the specifics within small groups of communities at a time. Those are going to run from late October through November, and we'll get the dates out to you actually quite shortly. That's everything.
All right, thank you. I appreciate everyone sticking with us for the whole meeting, including Jim, even though he is now working on other things. So I will move it to him to adjourn, to make a motion.
So move.
Thanks, Jim.
Second.
I have a motion and a second to adjourn. So I appreciate everyone joining us today.
Bye, everyone. Have a good day.
Au revoir.